This text was produced by Judy Boss of Omaha, Nebraska. Typhoon by Joseph Conrad. Far as the mariner on highest mast can see all around upon the calm vast, so wide was Neptune's hull. Keats. Author's note: the main characteristic of this volume consists in this, that all the stories composing it belong not only to the same period, but have been written one after another in the order in which they appear in the book. The period is that which follows on my connection with Blackwood's magazine. I had just finished writing The End of the Tether, and was casting about for some subject which could be developed in a shorter form than the tales in the volume of Youth, when the instance of a steamship full of returning coolies from Singapore to some port in northern China occurred to my recollection. Years before I had heard it being talked about in the East as a recent occurrence. It was for us merely one subject of conversation amongst many others of the kind. Men earning their bread in any very specialized occupation will talk shop, not only because it is the most vital interest of their lives, but also because they have not much knowledge of other subjects. They have never had the time to get acquainted with them. Life, for most of us, is not so much a hard as an exacting taskmaster. I never met anybody personally concerned in this affair, the interest of which for us was, of course, not the bad weather, but the extraordinary complication brought into the ship's life at a moment of exceptional stress by the human element below her deck. Neither was the story itself ever enlarged upon in my hearing. In that company each of us could imagine easily what the whole thing was like. The financial difficulty of it, presenting also a human problem, was solved by a mind much too simple to be perplexed by anything in the world except men's idle talk for which it was not adapted. From the first, the mere anecdote, the mere statement, I might say, that such a thing had happened on the high seas, appeared to me a sufficient subject for meditation. Yet it was but a bit of a sea yarn after all. I felt that to bring out its deeper significance, which was quite apparent to me, something other, something more was required. A leading motive that would harmonize all these violent noises, and a point of view that would put all that elemental fury into its proper place. What was needed, of course, was Captain McWhirr. Directly I perceived him, I could see that he was the man for the situation. I don't mean to say that I ever saw Captain McWhirr in the flesh, or had ever come in contact with his literal mind and his dauntless temperament. McWhirr is not an acquaintance of a few hours, or a few weeks, or a few months. He is the product of 20 years of life. My own life. Conscious invention had little to do with him. If it is true that Captain McWhirr never walked and breathed on this earth, which I find for my part extremely difficult to believe, I can also assure my readers that he is perfectly authentic. I may venture to assert the same of every aspect of the story, while I confess that the particular typhoon of the tale was not a typhoon of my actual experience. At its first appearance, Typhoon, the story, was classed by some critics as a deliberately intended storm piece. Others picked out McWhirr, in whom they perceived a definite symbolic intention. Neither was exclusively my intention. Both the Typhoon and Captain McWhirr presented themselves to me as the necessities of the deep conviction with which I approached the subject of the story. It was their opportunity. It was also my opportunity, and it would be vain to discourse about what I made of it in a handful of pages, since the pages themselves are here, between the covers of this volume, to speak for themselves. This is a belated reflection. If it had occurred to me before, it would have perhaps done away with the existence of this author's note, for, indeed, the same remark applies to every story in this volume. None of them are stories of experience in the absolute sense of the word. Experience in them is but the canvas of the attempted picture. Each of them has its more than one intention. With each, the question is what the writer has done with his opportunity, and each answers the question for itself in words which, if I may say so without undue solemnity, were written with a conscientious regard for the truth of my own sensations. And each of those stories, to mean something, must justify itself in its own way to the conscience of each successive reader. Falk, the second story in the volume, offended the delicacy of one critic at least by certain peculiarities of its subject. But what is the subject of Falk? I personally do not feel so very certain about it. He who reads must find out for himself. My intention in writing Falk was not to shock anybody. As in most of my writings, I insist not on the events, but on their effect upon the persons in the tale. But in everything I have written there is always one invariable intention, and that is to capture the reader's attention, by securing his interest and enlisting his sympathies for the matter in hand, whatever it may be, within the limits of the visible world, and within the boundaries of human emotions. I may safely say that Falk is absolutely true to my experience of certain straightforward characters combining a perfectly natural ruthlessness with a certain amount of moral delicacy. Falk obeys the law of self-preservation without the slightest misgivings, as to his right, but at a crucial turn of that ruthlessly preserved life he will not condescend to dodge the truth. As he is presented as sensitive enough to be affected permanently by a certain unusual experience, that experience had to be set by me before the reader vividly, but it is not the subject of the tale. If we go by mere facts, then the subject is Falk's attempt to get married, in which the narrator of the tale finds himself unexpectedly involved both on its ruthless and its delicate side. Falk shares with one other of my stories here, turn in the Tales of Unrest volume, the distinction of never having been serialized. I think the copy was shown to the editor of some magazine who rejected it indignantly on the sole ground that the girl never says anything. This is perfectly true. From first to last, Herman's niece utters no word in the tale, and it is not because she is dumb, but for the simple reason that whenever she happens to come under the observation of the narrator, as he has either no occasion or is too profoundly moved to speak. The editor, who obviously had read the story, might have perceived that for himself. Apparently he did not, and I refrained from pointing out the impossibility to him because, since he did not venture to say that the girl did not live, I felt no concern at his indignation. All the other stories were serialized. The Typhoon appeared in the early numbers of the Pall Mall magazine, then under the direction of the late Mr. Alcott. It was on that occasion, too, that I saw for the first time my conceptions rendered by an artist in another medium. Mr. Maurice Krefanthagen knew how to combine in his illustrations the effect of his own most distinguished personal vision with an absolute fidelity to the inspiration of the writer. My Foster was published in the Illustrated London News with a fine drawing of Amy on her day out giving tea to the children at her home, in a hat with a big feather. Oh Morrow appeared first in the Pall Mall magazine. Of that story I will only say that it struck many people by its adaptability to the stage, and that I was induced to dramatize it under the title of Need Day More, up to the present my only effort in that direction. I may also add that each of the four stories on their appearance in book form was picked out on various grounds as the best of the lot by different critics, who reviewed the volume with a warmth of appreciation and understanding, a sympathetic insight and a friendliness of expression for which I cannot be sufficiently grateful. 1919. J. C. Typhoon, I, Captain McWhirr, of the steamer Nanshan, had a physiognomy that, in the order of material appearances, was the exact counterpart of his mind. It presented no marked characteristics of firmness or stupidity. It had no pronounced characteristics whatever. It was simply ordinary, irresponsive, and unruffled. The only thing his aspect might have been said to suggest, at times, was bashfulness. Because he would sit, in business offices ashore, sunburned and smiling faintly, with downcast eyes. When he raised them, they were perceived to be direct in their glance, and of blue color. His hair was fair and extremely fine, clasping from temple to temple the bald dome of his skull in a clamp, as of fluffy silk. The hair of his face, on the contrary, carroty and flaming, resembled a growth of copper wire clipped short to the line of the lip, while, no matter how close he shaved, fiery metallic gleams passed, when he moved his head, over the surface of his cheeks. He was rather below the medium height, a bit round-shouldered, and so sturdy of limb, that his clothes always looked a shade too tight for his arms and legs. As if unable to grasp what is due to the difference of latitudes, he wore a brown bowler hat, a complete suit of a brownish hue, and clumsy black boots. These arbertocks gave to his thick figure an air of stiff and uncouth smartness. A thin silver watch chain looped his waistcoat, and he never left his ship for the shore without clutching in his powerful, hairy fist an elegant umbrella of the very best quality, but generally unrolled. Young Jukes, the chief mate, attending his commander to the gangway, would sometimes venture to say, with the greatest gentleness, "Allow me, sir," and possessing himself of the umbrella deferentially, would elevate the ferrule, shake the folds, twirl a neat furl in a jiffy, and hand it back, going through the performance with a face of such portentous gravity that Mr. Solomon Rout, the chief engineer, smoking his morning cigar over the skylight, would turn away his head in order to hide a smile. H. I. The blessed camp. Thank'ee, Jukes, thank'ee, would mutter Captain McWhirr, heartily, without looking up. Having just enough imagination to carry him through each successive day, and no more, he was tranquilly sure of himself, and from the very same cause he was not in the least conceited. It is your imaginative superior who is touchy, overbearing, and difficult to please, but every ship Captain McWhirr commanded was the floating abode of harmony and peace. It was, in truth, as impossible for him to take a flight of fancy as it would be for a watchmaker to put together a chronometer with nothing except a 2-pound hammer and a whipsaw in the way of tools. Yet the uninteresting lives of men so entirely given to the actuality of the bare existence have their mysterious side. It was impossible in Captain McWhirr's case, for instance, to understand what under heaven could have induced that perfectly satisfactory son of a petty grocer in Belfast to run away to sea. And yet he had done that very thing at the age of 15. It was enough, when you thought it over, to give you the idea of an immense, potent, and invisible hand thrust into the ant-heap of the earth, laying hold of shoulders, knocking heads together, and setting the unconscious faces of the multitude towards inconceivable goals and in undreamt of directions. His father never really forgave him for this undutiful stupidity. "We could have got on without him," he used to say later on, "but there's the business. And he an only son too." His mother wept very much after his disappearance. As it had never occurred to him to leave word behind, he was mourned over for dead till, after 8 months, his first letter arrived from Talcahuano. It was short, and contained the statement, "We had very fine weather on our passage out." But evidently, in the writer's mind, the only important intelligence was to the effect that his captain had, on the very day of writing, entered him regularly on the ship's articles as ordinary seaman. "Because I can do the work," he explained. The mother again wept copiously, while the remark, "Tom's an ass," expressed the emotions of the father. He was a corpulent man, with a gift for sly chaffing, which to the end of his life he exercised in his intercourse with his son, a little pityingly, as if upon a half-witted person. McWhirr's visits to his home were necessarily rare, and in the course of years he dispatched other letters to his parents, informing them of his successive promotions, and of his movements upon the vast earth. In these missives could be found sentences like this: "The heat here is very great," or "On Christmas Day at 4 p.m. we fell in with some icebergs." The old people ultimately became acquainted. acquainted with a good many names of ships, and with the names of the skippers who commanded them, with the names of Scots and English shipowners, with the names of seas, oceans, straits, promontories, with outlandish names of lumber ports, of rice ports, of cotton ports, with the names of islands, with the name of their son's young woman. She was called Lucy. It did not suggest itself to him to mention whether he thought the name pretty. And then they died. The great day of McWhirr's marriage came in due course, following shortly upon the great day when he got his first command. All these events had taken place many years before the morning when, in the chart room of the steamer Nan Shan, he stood confronted by the fall of a barometer he had no reason to distrust. The fall taking into account the excellence of the instrument, the time of the year, and the ship's position on the terrestrial globe was of a nature ominously prophetic. But the red face of the man betrayed no sort of inward disturbance. Omens were as nothing to him, and he was unable to discover the message of a prophecy till the fulfillment had brought it home to his very door. "Tee, that's a fall, and no mistake," he thought. "There must be some uncommonly dirty weather knocking about." The Nan Shan was on her way from the southward to the treaty port of Fuchao, with some cargo in her lower holds, and 200 Chinese coolies returning to their village homes in the province of Fujian, after a few years of work in various tropical colonies. The morning was fine, the oily sea heaved without a sparkle, and there was a queer white misty patch in the sky like a halo of the sun. The foredeck, packed with Chinamen, was full of somber clothing, yellow faces, and pigtails, sprinkled over with a good many naked shoulders, for there was no wind, and the heat was close. The coolies lounged, talked, smoked, or stared over the rail, some drawing water over the side, sluiced each other. A few slept on patches, while several small parties of six sat on their heels surrounding iron trays with plates of rice and tiny teacups, and every single celestial of them was carrying with him all he had in the world, a wooden chest with a ringing lock and brass on the corners, containing the savings of his labors. Some clothes of ceremony, sticks of incense, a little Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.